So good evening, Bodhisattvas. When Yunmen could freely roll in and roll out, one koan in the Book of Serenity begins. Rolling in, being attuned to knowing yourself as part of sameness or equality, everything rolled into one. Rolling out, by contrast, is seeing and feeling differentiation and multiplicity and something more. I want to explore both these aspects for a while tonight, since they're often part of archetypal Zen mappings of our practice. First caveat from here in the land of the Mobius strip, which I forgot to bring again. I'll bring one. If you find one, bring it in. If I give an example of rolling in and stare at it for a while, it sometimes has the unnerving tendency to morph into something that looks more like rolling out, and the reverse. This wobble might be partly a function of my own wobbly conceptual grasp, but I think it's also the nature of the beast. Since we're isolating aspects of a continuum, or provisionally making a dichotomy out of what's thunderously and radiantly not two, some slipping and sliding shouldn't surprise us. Caveat two is related. I hope you don't spend much time during your retreat worrying about or trying to pin down which kind of experience you're having, especially if it feels like you're kind of having both. My aim tonight isn't to delimit strict boundaries. There are more than enough of those to go around lately, but to maybe enlarge the territory you're prepared to regard as interesting or as Zen. Are you ready to bet the farm, Joan asks in her Vimalakirti book, that you can decide which moments to embrace and which to repudiate? In my experience, my practice history, a whole lot of what I used to be sure wasn't Buddhist experience turned out to be a crucial aspect of it. Rolling out was a case in point. Let's start, though, with rolling in, or kind of. Let's start with Shitto, a few lines from Taking Part in the Gathering, in Joan's translation. The mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. Trying to control things is only delusion, but hanging onto the absolute isn't enlightenment either. We and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven, and this interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. Excuse me. There's already a wobble here since a third term is introduced, an unusual aspect of Joan's translation. Things are interwoven or interpermeated, think rolling in, while each thing also stands over against the others in its own place, rolled out. But there's also the dark mysterious from which all of it streams. Joan links this explicitly to Taoism's intermingling with Chan Buddhism in China. Shitto's poem, after all, has the same title as an older Taoist poem. One of Joan's images for this dark source is a well at the center of the temple, tunneling down to a place or a no place that's unknowable, endarkenment in one of its aspects. The tradition tells us this primordial darkness is not what's meant by shunyata or emptiness, at least for Indian Buddhism, since emptiness means empty of self-nature. It's things so interpermeated that there aren't actually things. It isn't the void or an impenetrable darkness. Despite this, something like this primordial dark turns up in classic accounts of working with Zhao Zhou's no koan, among other places. Lin Zhi says of the no place encountered in no practice, the whole universe is sheer darkness. And Hakuin recalls, it was like sitting in an ice cave a million miles thick. The no place of 0 degree Kelvin, no thing moving. In her talks on endarkenment, Joan often mentions dark matter. From a certain vantage, there isn't anything at all, or barely anything. And in meditation, we can fall into it, which isn't an it. Important qualifier, I should note, going back to the notion of archetypal Zen narratives, that things tend to get told in a certain order. First you experience this, then that. But I think in practice, anything might happen at any time. You don't have to try to book a visit to the land of sheer darkness as the first stop on your awakening itinerary. Plus, I don't think everyone spends time in the ice cave. I know one person who is pretty surprised to find themselves there several years after experiencing Kensho. Some people find the ice cave calm and tranquil. Others find it disconcerting, to put it mildly. I don't think anyone stays there forever, and the tradition certainly doesn't want you to. Case in point, Wu Men, in his comments on the No Koan in his Gateless Gate, is quite clear that the 0 degree Kelvin experience isn't the story, or at least not all of the story. Don't consider no to be nothingness, he says. There's another image, I think it's also Wu Men on no, but I can't seem to find it, of a black ball moving through the impenetrable darkness, gradually picking up both speed and size, something or some primordial energy stirring in the stillness. Why is there something rather than nothing? Heidegger asked. So rolling in isn't quintessentially about the void, but about things revealing themselves as not separate, as not things, but an endless weave or wave of morphing energy, often figured as light. Branches of light stream from that dark, says Shitto. Lately, I've been thinking of our experience of emptiness as a moment where figure and ground change places, kind of sliding through one another, so that the background looms forward and fills your attention, while all the significant individual creatures and objects you had fixed in the foreground of your perception and attention a moment ago recede or blur. There are actually film sequences where the shift is brilliantly rendered, among them Bertolucci's Little Buddha, Scorsese's Kundun, and maybe more surprisingly, since it's not a movie about Buddhism and is in many respects pretty objectionable, Sam Mendes's American Beauty. The field itself comes to dominate your attention, more palpable than the things held within it. A typical trigger event for this figure ground reversal provokes for me one of those is it rolling in or is it rolling out confusions. Joan talks of meditation making us fetchable and about how awakening happens in relation, our relation to someone or something else. It can often feel like what fetches us suddenly looms forward, zooming toward us in a kind of perceptual bending, stupendous or subtle. The cherry blossoms, the sound of a pebble going tock against bamboo, a plastic window tassel blown a little and uplifted slightly in the breeze, the little red dot on an old-fashioned radio dial that zooms forward right at you. But a common feature of these rolling in moments is that this looming thing, whatever it is, pulls us into the field, a sort of Alice in Wonderland effect, till we feel we've become part of the omnipresent background into which the other individual creatures and things have also tumbled. In these moments, often, we can feel or sense the medium that surrounds or immerses us in a visceral, sometimes kinetic way, the background subsuming the foreground. If we're typically unaware of the air through which we move as an actual medium, if it seems to be no more than empty Euclidean space, in these experiences of rolling in, air can sometimes feel thick and viscous, and we can sense it buoying us up as it actually does, almost like water. The light, too, can seem viscous, the shimmers like something being poured. Kinetic identifications, our sense that our bodies are registering how some other creature or object feels when it moves the way it does, are multiple, soft, and diffuse in the rolling in phase, as if the waves of air that buoy us up also play through us, arriving as echoed rhythms of the motions of other creatures moving in the same field. Sound can have similar qualities, augmenting the sense that we're bathed in the blur or blend. Here's Whitman in a wonderfully strange moment in Song of Myself, where a you, who's ambiguously the poet's lover or his own soul, also takes the form of a voice emitting a stream of viscous sound. Loaf with me on the grass, loose the stop from your throat. Not words, not music or rhyme I want, not custom or lecture, not even the best. Only the lull I like, the hum of your valved voice. Here's another figure ground reversal, Inside the play of sounds, we feel the presence of silence. Inside all the motion, stillness. Or maybe not inside them, but actually as them, the two surfaces of the Möbius strip, which turn out to be a single surface. Sound as silent, movement, sound as silence, movement as stillness. There's a deep tranquility in such moments that one can rest in, and one might well want to stay there. Case 23 of the Blue Cliff record opens in a high mountain spot that seems to embody this radiant stillness. When Baofo and Changqing went on a picnic in the hills, Baofo pointed to the top of a hill saying, "That's the top of Miao Peak." Jones footnote, Miao Peak is the peak of wonder, the center of paradise, according to the Huayan Sutra. His companion senses trouble, though. "That's true, you're right," said Changqing, "but a pity." A third party agrees. Later, Baofo told Jingqing about this. Jingqing said, "If it were not for Master Changqing, skulls would appear in every field." Rolled into this experience where it feels like nothing's missing, where there's nothing you need to go get, and no gnawing sense of lack propels you, after all, you're interpermeated with all of it, one might fall out of life's characteristic ruckus, which turns out to be a bad thing, a Cohen School no-no. Changqing's pivot in this case, that is, turns out to be entirely characteristic of the koans. When you get there, women's commentaries on the Blue Cliff record say over and over again of such mystic peak moments, you need a place to turn around. One koan says, you have to be able to put it to use on the road. This turn isn't only an act of self-preservation, think skulls littering the ground, or a moment of generosity, be useful to others, though it's those things in part. Rolling out is also a pouring forth, and once this surge takes hold of you, it feels surprisingly like the natural expression of what's happened in rolling in. And it can feel like a torrent or an explosion, powerful and ebullient. It might not initially feel like Zen. Depending on your Zen preconceptions, it might even feel like anathema. Some years ago at a retreat outside Santa Fe, Jones Cohen's seminar included a couple of cases featuring birds and a hearer's response to them. In the first koan, which I can't find anymore, the listener hearing the birds simply disappeared, losing all awareness of self, subsumed. Everyone liked that. The second koan, a poem by Ikkyu actually, provoked a raft of objection and discomfort. Here it is. "The instant that crow laughed, a hearer rose up from the ordinary dust. In this morning sunshine, an illuminated face sings." Here, getting fetched provokes not, or not only, a tumbling into the field, an emptiness or an interpermeation, but a blossoming back up out of it. Here I am. The crow calls, intensely itself, crow all the way down, through and through, and in doing so, calls you to come forth too, calls you into being, to Tathagata, your suchness. A couple years earlier, I was pretty suspicious and standoffish too. Someone quoted the end of Whitman's Song of Myself on an open source discussion board, and I'd written a long book on Whitman, after all, had something to say. I said, yes, okay, the end part was very Zen, all interpermeation. It's beautiful, Walt dissolved into the field, and I'll read it again, even though I read it last night. "I depart as air, I shake my white locks at the runaway sun, I effuse my flesh in eddies and drifted in lacy jags. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere waiting for you." But the lines right above those didn't fit. "The spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. I too am not a bit untamed. I too am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world. My barbaric yawp, please. Definitely not Zen, I felt. Too much exuberant self here. I was a little less dogmatic posting to the list, I hope. But Mary Montoya replied, I'd like to think that in this moment, both the hawk and Walt learn something. Seeing Walt and responding, the hawk gets to be a hawk in spades. Called and fetched by the hawk, Walt gets to be Walt. Untamed, just himself, untranslatable, nobody else, barbaric, yawp, and all. Tathagata. The tradition makes it clear that for Zen, swooping and yawping are kosher. Turning around and blasting back into the ruckus is part of the Mahayana turn. So Shuto, again, in Jones' translation, we and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven. This interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. Suzuki Roshi's commentary on Shuto's poem, Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness, emphasizes just this point. He contrasts Ri, the absolute or the source, to Ji, the relative. Emptiness as interpermeation, where things interweave and thus resist categorization, are Ri, which is indefinable. If you define it, it's not Ri anymore, Suzuki says. But, hang on, it turns out that for Suzuki, individual creatures and things, in their suchness, their Tathagata aspect, are Ri too, and also undefinable. Here's a long quotation. The various beings that we see and hear are interrelated, but at the same time, each being is absolutely independent and has its own value. This value we call Ri. Ri is that which makes something meaningful. Even though you don't attain enlightenment, we say you already have enlightenment. That enlightenment we call Ri. It is very strange that no two things are the same. There is nothing to compare yourself to, so you have your own value. That value is not a comparative value or an exchange value. It is more than that. When you are just sitting zazen on the cushion, you have your own value. Although that value is related to everything, that value is absolute. And then with a characteristic Suzuki charming demur, maybe it is better not to say too much. A bit further on, mulling over this interrelated, absolutely independent Mobius strip, Suzuki says, if you don't understand Zen words, you don't understand Zen. Zen words are different from usual words. Like a double-edged sword, they cut both ways. You may think I am only cutting forward, but no, actually, I am also cutting backward. Watch out for my stick. Do you understand? So rolling out isn't simply multiplicity or difference. It's also rewrite here to Tathagata. You, the crow and hawk, and the cypress tree in Zhaozhou's courtyard, and in a certain mode of attention, whatever is before you, womp. Sometimes it feels eruptive, like Quaker Oats. Sorry, 1950s TV commercial. Big antique cannon into which oats are stuffed, then heated, to come blasting out, blam, and flack into an invisible plexiglass shield right before they are about to blast through the TV screen and hit you in the face. Quaker Oats, says the voiceover, shot from a gun. Meant, I guess, by some marketing guru as an image of ultimate freshness. For me, all these years later, unlikely image of Tathagata. As long as I'm exfoliating images, there's also the pneumatic tube, which makes a vacuum in front of a little plastic vessel to speed your package to you, thwap, instantly, since there's no air in the tube to impede the motion. Your book at the NYC 42nd Street Reference Library or your prescription at CVS. Direct from the source in an instant without friction or hindrance, Tathagata. Your original face, not you in your karmic aspect. Quickly, before your parents were born, thwap. This Tathagata face of things isn't always so dramatic, not all cawing crows and hawks and Quaker oats. Here's Gateless Gate 12. Every day, Ju Yen called master to himself and answered, yes. Then he would ask, are you awake? And reply, yes. Don't be deceived by others, anytime or anywhere. No, no. On the whole, though, accounts of transformative moments of rolling in and rolling out tend to be pyrotechnical. Here are two hinge moments, great teachers recounting dramatic encounters in which their own teachers tried to give them a place to turn around from rolling in to letting rolling out roll out. Both are from Zenkai Shimayama's commentary on Jiaozhou's No Koan from the Gateless Gate. The first is about Hakuin. We read the following moving story of his first encounter with his teacher, Master Shouju. Shouju asked Hakuin, "Tell me, what is Joshu's mu?" Hakuin elatedly replied, "Pervading the universe, not a spot whatsoever to take hold of." As soon as he had given that answer, Shouju took hold of Hakuin's nose and gave it a twist. "I am quite at ease to take hold of it," said Shouju, laughing aloud. The next moment he released it and abused Hakuin. "You, dead monk in a cave, are you self-satisfied with such mu?" The second is about Shibayama himself. My teacher also asked me once, "Show me the form of mu." When I said it has no form whatsoever, he pressed me, saying, "I want to see that form that has no form." How cutting and drastic, Shibayama says. Unless one can freely and clearly present the form of mu, it turns out to be a meaningless corpse. Hakuin, the formless form comes into form. And it does. These Zen stories, which are unmistakably Zen stories, are pretty wonderful, and they highlight transformations of perception and also of person that are extreme, dramatic, and often lasting. They're a key part of the romance of Koan Zen and of its promise. They can recur. Hakuin, a Zen genius, supposedly had 18 major kenshos and too many minor ones to count. But for most of us, most of the time, these high points are either conjured in anticipation or seen in the rearview mirror. What then? Do they, to mix metaphors, have an afterlife? Stay tuned. Thank you. I would welcome any questions or discussions or disagreements or stories. Typically, we leave the recorder on every night except for the Koan seminar, so I hope that's all right.
I was caught by your word anathema, and I wondered, really, is there anything anathema in Zen?
No, so that was a joke. Yeah. But we've been reading Jun's Vimalakirti book, and there are all these passages where she talks about, you know, the private Buddhist setting up this against that, or saying flowers are especially bad, and so they, you know, the goddess showers them with flowers and they try to brush them off because they're not supposed to wear adornments and the flowers stick to them and so on. And in our discussion, one of the places we got is that it's sort of easy to laugh at those guys, you know, oh flowers. But I mean, I think for all of us, Zen practice goes through a lot of moments or periods where we do that, right? Where we say, this is the practice, this isn't. Right? I mean, I know we're not supposed to, but that's it.
Maybe we do. I can't think of that offhand. I think of it as being so inclusive.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. So what I was doing then, I guess, is I was doing what we said not to do in the Vimalakirti group. I was poking fun at those other people but I was poking fun at myself too, because I was saying, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I'm hoping I'm not the only one who has a tendency over the years to triage my practice experience and say, that's pretty good, that shouldn't be happening, that's kind of interesting, but I don't think it's where I'm supposed to be going. You know, and I mean, I know that's not the deal, but.
Even though it's all within the field of the call.
Yeah. And then the other thing would be, of course, that when we do that, that's not a problem either, right?
So that having a place to stand, is that the same as...
To turn around. Yeah.
A place to turn around. Is that the same as the transition, the rolling in and the rolling
out? There are all these moments in the Koans, maybe especially in the Blue Cliff record, because the editor, Yuan Wu, who's pretty fierce, is like on about this constantly, but there's all this stuff about sort of sinking into quietude as not being the deal. And sometimes there's a sort of bad polemic that says that like the Soto guys sink into quietude, but Koan Zen guys don't, you know. But I think that, you know, that's a polemic and it's not really true. I think in the tradition as a whole, there's a great emphasis on that turnaround and sort of bringing it back into activity and exuberant energy. Yeah.
Okay, that's clear.
Yeah. I've only practiced Zen, so this is also not going to be accurate, but sometimes I have a sense in doing work in the room with people who've come from other traditions that Zen maybe places an especially clear emphasis on that part of the practice, but I don't, again, it's probably not right.
It certainly elaborates it into a lot of paradox more than Vipassana, say.
Yeah.
Doesn't go there.
Yeah. I think in a way it's paradox, yeah, and in a way it's just, you know, there's a lot of rooms in the house. You know. So.
Well, and some of those traditions don't have the turning around.
Yeah, I don't know the other traditions. So,
I mean, that's a Mahayana thing, really.
I mean, that's what we say, and I just don't. I mean, if you went and knocked on a door that wasn't a Mahayana door, they might say, "Oh, that's not right." Yes, Shelley.
Well, I don't know. I've just been kind of meditating recently on this phrase, "painting myself into a corner," and I feel like I do that sometimes. I paint myself into a corner where I'm sort of stuck. And I don't know if that's rolling in. And it feels very constricted, and I sort of don't know how to get out of the corner. But there is a way, it seems. But I don't know, sometimes with the practice it seems that things become very tight or rolled in or backed up or kind of. But I think it has something to do with concepts, with painting myself into a corner.
Yeah, I certainly do that too. From what you're saying, it's not clear to me that the corner you think you're painting yourself into is the rolling in corner. Because when you talk about it as sort of tight and I guess if everything gets really quiet and there's kind of nothing or everything interpermeates, I guess if you really want to stay there, then it feels constricted.
Yeah, I think it's somehow in my mind, it becomes a one-way situation.
Yeah.
Whether it's in life or I realize, I think I have to do this, and then it gets constricted.
Yeah.
Like, and I found that when I was doing more koans, that there was like some sort of strange insistence in my mind. I was going to get to something through this.
Yeah.
And it was like, no. You know? No. And I'm like, yes.
Yeah.
And then I was just sort of like, okay, here I am. Just in the corner. It's like not going, you know?
But that's interesting.
It may have nothing to do with anything you're talking about.
I don't know. That's really interesting to me. In my experience, I'm really stubborn and change resistant and stuff, you know. Just ask my family, you know. But so I identify with what you're saying. I guess I feel that in my experience the Koans tend to work against that because they're always changing up on you, you know. And also for me when I was doing Koan work with Joan, just how many of them there were. I remember finishing one, and then of course she'd give you another one. I remember thinking, you guys just don't quit, you know. And so each Koan is an experience like, I don't know what the fuck this is about. Do you know what I mean? I mean, so that sense of being like sort of completely, you know, adrift and just, you know, waiting till the place clarifies enough around you so that you begin to know how to move in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a tradition, John also used to say that at least in the miscellaneous koans, there's a tendency to sort of throw you back and forth between rolling in and rolling out. You know, get one that's all about tranquility, and right after they get you, that, you get, you know, go straight up the mountain road with 99 curves or something like that. So it's always throwing you off balance and kind of back and forth between those two aspects. Yeah, that's helpful.
Thank you.
What the other thing it reminds me of is not about enlightenment, but about Zen practice. But Suzuki, in you know that wonderful book, To Shine One Corner of the World, or Zen is Right Here. Somebody asked him, remember, is enlightenment a complete remedy? And he says, no, but it's a pretty good remedy. You know. So I think you know, practice is not for me a complete remedy, but I mean, it seems like sometimes a pretty good one.
I don't think he says it's pretty good. It's a pretty good. I think he just says no.
Oh. All right. Well, then I just made up a comment.
I just read it. But okay. Maybe right. It is a pretty right. Good one.
Okay. Thank you.
I had a question. Now, since you warned us against trying to decide which oh. One is which experience, I think I'll walk right into it.
Yeah.
So, in one of the first cons you talked about last night, where Shui Feng is saying, I'm not going to remember which one said,
yeah.
Said which, but...
Shui Feng asked a question, yeah.
What? So, with one of them, it's just this.
Yeah, that's Yanto, yeah.
And with the other one, it's
yeah.
What is this?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, is just this rolling in?
Yeah, that, I'm going to talk about those Saturday night, but I'm going to lead up to it tomorrow night. So, and I also just did the con with somebody in work in the room a couple of weeks ago. I think there's a million ways to cut that one, you know.
Mm-hmm. It's been appearing that way all day to me.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of in my corner with it.
Yeah. I mean, I actually won't say anything about it because, I mean, you can say some more, but I don't want to say more about which I think is...
Okay.
Is which, but I will say I think for me one of them tends to come to a point more, and the other feels a little more diffuse. So I guess in that sense,
right,
that's right. It
I
is
mean.
Like yeah, I think
so,
that's
so
right.
So what is this? Feels like it's all the particularity taking form.
Well, one thing I'm gonna try and do with it when I talk about it is associate it also with this sort of middle non pyrotechnical state. When neither are you tumbled into the field really dramatically, nor is it a Quaker Oats moment, you know. But you're just living the rest of your life, and what good was your Zen experience anyway?
Can I ask one more?
Yeah, please.
It seemed to me that Joan always said not to, and then. When I actually look in Suzuki, he says, not one, not two.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wondered if you had a sense of why she went with just the not two.
I have a very particular memory of her at Okamura doing the not one and not two.
Oh, I wasn't at that one.
Yeah, yeah. And talking about a sort of bland and pernicious sense of oneness, that if you think, you know, but talking instead about the sense of a sort of intimate reception of somebody kind of in their Tathagata quality, so that they're inside you in some way. And then in that context, she talked about not one and not two. I don't know, for me, I think like in the Vimalakirti book, she's so much marshaling it against that tendency, you know, to say this is good practice, this isn't, that she's stressing the not to. And what do you think? Do you have a sense
of that? Well, that was my sense, is that that's more what our tendency is. That's what the habit body
yeah.
wants to do, is
yeah.
to make two out of everything,
yeah.
to polarize everything.
Yeah.
You know, and I find in my practice, you know, I sort of can locate the axis and then the tendency is to say, well, this is what corresponds to this, and then realize, oh, I'm not actually sure about that either. You know, like
yeah.
I don't know which one
yeah.
which one corresponds to which, I can just feel that they're on the same axis.
Yeah. I mean, the Möbius strip thing, that's the thing I like about it, because it really isn't either two surfaces or one. And the experience of being on one side and knowing there's another side is pretty palpable. But then if you trace along it, it turns out it was the same one.
You know? And don't you think, therefore, don't you think that the idea of the Möbius strip is compelling because it's somewhat of a resolution to the duality in... And I wonder about the energy of that, because it's all the same, you know, two sides of the same thing, so it's like, whoa, what, you know, here's these two, what gets it, that turning point, or that, you know, where it goes over to the other side, it's like, well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Sometimes it's like, how did that happen?
Yeah. And then another aspect really is not controlling the happening of it, but recognizing it when it does happen.
That's great, I think, And also, I think such a strong possibility and a frequent occurrence in retreats is how somebody's retreat, like mine, you know, turns into its opposite. And the particular version for me is, do you know, John used to talk about bucket work, you know, so it's sort of all the psychological. So it's like, I didn't come to the retreat to do bucket work. I want to get enlightened, please, you know. So, and then it's like, day three, and I'm thinking about how my grandmother was mean to my grandfather and what that had to do with my mother and the kind of person I turned out to be. You know, it's like, I don't want to be having this kind of retreat. It's like, it's a million miles just to get back to go, you know, let alone to have an opening or something. And those moments just so often will just turn into, like, the next moment, everything opens, you know. So, I don't know, that's like...
So just being ready for it, kind of, too, right?
So that's like, you remember Joan talking about readiness to awaken rather than, what is it, rather than being the school of sudden awakening, the Cohen school, in a better translation, is the school of readiness to awaken. So yeah, just, you know, not being too dug into the particular hole you think you're in at the moment, you know. So.
Or a corner.
So let me say one other thing. I don't want to cut off. I hope there are more questions if there are. But in a way, this has something to... It's not exactly right, but it has something to do with the thing about, you know, non-self or self, which is also kind of a Möbius strip. And, you know, we don't have a language for all the parts of the person. So when Joan kept giving her talks about this other thing that wasn't self, she'd have to say, oh, but yourself, you know, there's no way to talk about it. But, you know, whether we call it a self or not, my sense of, you know, the important Zen teachers I've known and other teachers of other kinds is the sense that they're standing in their own place is really strong for me, you know. I mean, the sense that they're interpermeated with everything also, but, you know, they're just... They're a real presence, and they are who they are, and that's, you know, that seems very striking, at least to me. I don't know how it strikes other people, but it seemed like a strong, and it's one reason they're really good company too, you know, I think.
Yeah, it seems like that's where the duality of non-duality meets.
I know that sounds stupid. So anything else?
Oh.
Yeah.
So the Shuifeng koan had a second part last night.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if that was in a different book.
No, we just made it up.
You made it up?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And that's the same thing with the with that one, and also the thing that's on the cone sheet about the mending or not, you know, how do you mend?
I wasn't sure. I was going back and forth on that.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I realized that, you know, we did the, we'll talk about that, you know, but the, you know, we've been, they're traveling together, and who are the two teachers?
It's Dongshan
and some.
Oh, that
is.
Shenzhen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So Dongshan says, well, how do you mend? And Shenzhen?
One
stitch is like the next, and Dongshan says, you know, we've been traveling together for all this time, and how can you say that? And he asks Dongshan, how do you mend? As if the earth were spewing flames, right? Which is really beautiful. But last year we turned it around and thought it was really a reversible cone. So Dongshan says, you know, as if the earth were spewing flames, and Shenzhen says, oh, you know, how can you talk like that? And I realized later that actually when Norman Fisher was in town giving a talk for Al Kasniak, he actually used that cone. He didn't flip it explicitly, but he sort of talked about how, you know, the answers seemed equally good to him. And so we did kind of the same thing with the with the Shui Feng and the Yantou cone. And we'll come back to that one.
Yeah, I was all looking for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so thanks very much, and we'll continue this tomorrow night with things that are less dramatic. I'm going to talk about cones that are Warhol-esque, like Andy Warhol. So.